if you take perfectly reasonable physics and you integrate out short distance physics, there's nothing that stops you. Where the short distance physics was stable and there was no runaway phenomenon, the short distance physics, the process of integrating out that short distance physics can give you these interactions which at face value are giving you runaway modes. And so the question is, how do you understand that? And the conclusion, I think, is that what I'm going to argue is that there's no criterion that you should exclude these interactions that naively give you runaway modes. I want to say, what I'd like to say is that the runaway modes are beyond the domain of validity of the effective theory, and you shouldn't be trusting them anyway. So, since I've talked about this much, let me do that, because we've almost had half the discussion right now. So, and also there's related to that is the issue of if I give you an effective theory and you solve its equations of motion, to what extent is it capturing the solutions of the full theory? Which has got to be related to the stability story, right? Because if you have a stable full theory, then its solutions will not have any runaway solutions. And so if the effective theory has runaway solutions, that would mean that the effective theory solutions are not capturing the full theory solutions. So you'd like to understand when you can trust the solutions for the effective theory. Okay, so let's do that. Unless there's a question from the. Yeah. So the issue is, what do you do? You know, we've been thinking that there's been a background and a fluctuation, and what if that background had been time dependent? Or what if we were looking at, we calculate an effective theory and we look for a time dependent solution in the effective theory? Should I be able to think of that as a fluctuation around some time-dependent solution in the full theory? And there's a lot to be said here, and I'm not going to say there's a whole theory of fluctuations around cosmological solutions that I'm not going to be going into. But I want to address the issues of principle. So, is an effective field theory useful at all, given that its definition assumes a conserved energy, and that is used to distinguish low energy from high energy states? And I want to argue, so that's question one. And then question two will be the specific issue of are solutions, so like non-vacuum solutions. Let's phrase it this way. When do solutions of the effective theory capture behavior of solutions of the full theory? In particular, a subtext of this is there an issue of runaway solutions that you have to think about in a special way? And the argument I'm going to answer, the answer I'm going to argue for is that there is, for generic time-dependent problem, there's not a useful effective field theory way to think about it. But in situations where you have adiabatic time evolution, then there is an effective field theory way of thinking about things. And so one of the things we're going to want to know is, what's the domain of validity of the effective field theory? And so far the story has been that we want there to be a hierarchy of scales between the energies of interest to us and the energies of the things we integrated out. And so those will now have a time-dependent component to them. We'll have to ask that just because they're satisfied at some time won't mean that they have to be satisfied at all times. So we'll have to ask that the criterion for the effective field theory to work, you have to check it at later times. And this, and the, for the second part, I want to argue that that it is not true that the solutions, that all the solutions of the effective field theory agree with all the solutions of the full theory. But what is true is that if we ask for the solutions, all an effective field theory is supposed to do is to capture the physics of the full theory order by order in 1/1 the heavy scale. Because that's the only time it became local, right? So the only reason we were doing local things was we were doing a Taylor expansion in 1/m. And so if you ask, so the statement I think I want to argue is true is that all of the solutions, all of the adiabatic solutions of the full theory are being captured by the solutions of the effective theory. So it's, again, adiabaticity is going to play an important role. So there will be time-dependent solutions of the full theory which the effective theory equations won't capture, but the adiabatic solutions the effective theory will capture, and it'll capture them for free. So in particular, I'll show you that at the classical level, there's a very general argument that says that the solutions of the effective theory are capturing what the solutions of the full theory said. And along the way there, you'll see what happens to these runaway solutions. Okay, that's the goal. All right, so the first part of it is going to be, you know, if you have, for adiabatic evolution, we're imagining that there's some background quantity phi, or it could be a metric or something that depends on time. And the adiabatic limit is normally the case where if I take phi, you know, d phi dt, 1/phi times d phi dt, that defines an energy scale. I call that omega. So this is the definition, maybe. What we want is, you know, we're imagining that we have two scales in the problem. We have a big scale, capital M, and we have some light scales. And what we want is that this is another one of the light scales. So we're going to ask that omega is much less than the scale which defines the heavy particles. Kind of more formally, what you would mean is that if the time variation of any background fields is slow enough, then at every time you could parametrically at every time identify the Hamiltonian and you could diagonalize it, and you'd get a whole bunch of eigenvalues, each of which would be a function of time. And then if the time evolution is slow enough, that's a good description of what the real eigenvalues, the time evolution of a state would be, the good approximation, you know, e to the minus I integral of e of tau d tau. And so it's useful to, you know, if you knew what these energy eigenfunctions were, eigenvalues were as a function of time, then states are going to evolve in the way that you think they should, but they'll have the time dependence to them. If the time dependence is not slow, then the time dependence of a real state is not going to be captured by something like this, and then it's a much more difficult problem to figure out how things behave. But there's a regime for slowly enough varying background fields for which you can think of at every time there being the Hamiltonian is the time is like a parameter in the Hamiltonian, but you can diagonalize the Hamiltonian at that time to figure out the energy eigenvalues as a function of time. And the states evolve in a way which is, you know, if this had not depended on time, this would have been e to the minus I e t, which is the usual thing. And so it's a small change to what you think of as the time evolution of a system if energy had been conserved. So if you're in that regime, then you have a notion of an approximate eigenvalue for energy. So we're imagining that we've got a time-dependent energy, and we're solving for the time-dependent energy eigenvalues, and if this is sufficiently small, then what will happen is that this will be, these energy eigenvalues are a useful, if I start off with a system that's in one of these energy eigenvalues, it will essentially sit there and rotate by this phase, and I won't have transitions amongst all these energy states. So it's, whereas if I have an arbitrary time-dependent system, then there's no sense in which, if I start with an energy eigenstate, I stay there, because H isn't conserved. So H is kind of adiabatically conserved, if you like, here. And the point of this is that once you have these approximate energy eigenvalues, you can use them to distinguish what's high energy versus low energy. So what you do is you'll use, you know, En of t to differentiate low from high energy. So, for example, you know, we'd have Q would be much less than, so what we call Q of t would be much less than some scale lambda, much less than M of t. But because things are functions of time, you have to check that Q of t is much less than M of t for all t of interest. And in particular, the kind of thing that's dangerous in this kind of a picture is if you have some energy level that's not doing anything, and you've got another energy level which is very slowly changing, but it's changing in a secular way which is making it grow, and eventually the levels cross. Once they're the same energy, then you know that it becomes an issue of the degenerate perturbation theory. And what really happens is that the energy eigenvalues do something like this. But if you climb very, very slowly, then you'll come out as this state rather than continuing. And so this kind of level crossing is dangerous because the basic assumption, if you were supposing this was a scale M and this is the scale Q, if you were trying to integrate out the scale M and you're going to say that I'm going to ignore everything that's above this scale, then you might get burned because you might find that although there might be a clean hierarchy here, maybe this is 100 times bigger than this is at some time. At later times, they may be not different from each other. And so what you should then be expecting is that your effective theory will have some domain of validity, but eventually it's going to fail. And then you'll need some sort of a better theory to describe the place where it fails. So the zeroth order thing is you're just going to apply the same criterion you'd used before, but you have to demand that the criterion is not, because everything is a function of time, that the hierarchy of scales that you start off with, you want it to stay hierarchical as time evolves, to stay within the domain of validity of the effective theory. And you don't want anyone else who's heavy to come out and become light. So that's observation number one. That's kind of a fairly simple one. So what about, any questions about that before I wasn't going to say much more than that. So for part number two, you could ask, so in our toy example, so question two, when do the solutions to the field equation for L effective, so for example, in our toy example, that was, you know, we had minus 1/2 d mu xi, minus a m to the fourth capture the solutions to our phone theory, which is minus d mu phi star, d mu phi star, d mu phi. And now, so the zeroth order argument I want to give you is that it looks like they always do. So why would you think that's true? Why should you think that the field equations of the low energy theory should capture what's going on in the high energy theory? So remember that we could make the argument for the one particle, one light particle irreducible generating functional, but let me work at the classical level because that's normally the case that you're interested in practice. So remember at the classical level, we had that the Wilson action as a function of the light fields was the full action as a function of the light field, and the function of the heavy fields evaluated as functions of light fields. So where we solve delta S delta H at H of L is equal to zero. That was our algorithm for calculating this effective Wilson action. And I showed you that if you did this, if we solve these equations in the example we looked at, order by to the first order in 1 over m squared, then it gave you the same answer for this coefficient A that we also got graphically by looking at demanding that scattering of the light particles agreed. So this is kind of a true statement at the classical level. And at the quantum level, we'd have a similar statement where this would now be the one generator of one light particle irreducible graph, and this would be the generator of all one particle graphs, one particle irreducible graphs, as opposed to one light particle irreducible graph. Okay. So this makes it sound superficially like it's always going to be true that if I solve the equation of motion for S, so if delta S delta L is zero, then it seems like how could I fail to solve the equation of motion? Because I first solved the heavy equation of motion, and then I solved light field equation of motion. And you might have said, well, it's not quite true. It's as simple as that. Alex, can I get you to turn off the mute and mute the sound?
Sorry. How do I mute?
Thanks. So you might say it's not completely trivial because there's an L dependence here that you didn't have before. But of course, if I differentiate S, delta L, using the chain rule, it'll be delta S, delta L, with H fixed. And then there'll be a piece where I take delta S, delta H, with L fixed, times dH dL. And this was zero. So really, it's going to be true that if I set this equal to zero, I'm solving the equations of motion I would have been solving for the full theory. So it sounds like I've solved this equation and this equation. I've solved them all. Let's stop talking about it. And what's deceptive here, that's a deceptive argument. That's the dangerous thing, is that people will look at this and they'll say, well, so it must be true that any solution to delta S weight delta L equals zero reflects something that happened in the full theory. And that's the thing I want to argue against. So I want to argue this is false. So it's simplest to have an example here. So let's take L to be, and let's just focus on time dependence because the issue here is going to be mostly time dependence. So let's take L to be 1/2 Q dot squared, or let's say phi dot squared. Let's say L dot squared. And then let's add something which has, we'll have a constant over M. Squared L dot dot squared. Let's take that. The dimensions are right. So this is mass squared. So this is mass cubed, and I square it. That's mass to the sixth. So I had to have an m squared to get the dimensions right, and so on. So let's say that's what our effective theory is. So then the equations of motion for this would have been that, you know, if I vary L, I'm gonna get I vary the action. So I'm going to get L dot, delta L dot. Let's put a 2 in here just to make the numbers easier. Plus C over M squared, L dot dot, delta L dot dot. So what I would normally then do is I want to integrate by parts to write. So I want to write this as something times delta L. So I'd have integral, and let me suppose I just drop the surface terms I get by integrating by parts. So I have boundary conditions that allow me to do that, let's say. So I'll get integral dt of minus L dot dot. And here I have to, if I integrate by parts once, I'm going to have L dot 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 times delta L dot. So I'm not done yet. I have to integrate by parts again to get all the derivatives over there. So I'm going to get two sign changes because of that. Of C over M squared L dot 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 times delta L plus surface terms. So these are the things that were the total derivatives. So that means that the equation of motion is going to be L dot dot minus C over M squared L dot 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 is equal to zero. And right away, you can kind of see that things should be qualitatively different. If we had only the first term, then that is a second order equation in time. It's the usual thing that we think that we should be able to specify the value of L and the value of L dot at initial time, and then we get to evolve it forward in time for free. But now, because it's a fourth order equation, we're actually going to have to specify L, L dot, and L dot dot, and L dot 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 at the initial time and evolve them all forward. You know, before we could use this equation to step forward what the fourth derivative is if we knew what the third and the second derivatives were. But if we imagine doing this on a computer, you'd need to actually specify the first three derivatives and the function itself. So there's more initial data needed. And that means that there should be more solutions going on here than you're normally used to. So what's going on? So the solutions to this thing, I would claim, are this is actually not the example I wanted to do, but let's see if I can wing it. So this is the solutions are, you know, this is d2 dt squared of this is zero. So we know that L dot dot C over M squared minus that plus L is equal to a constant plus another constant times T. So now I have to solve this in real time. Right, that's what I want. Good, thank you. I can never teach again without having you in the room. Okay. So the homogeneous solution is the one I'm interested in. So the homogeneous solution, so L homogeneous solves L homogeneous dot dot minus M squared over C L is equal to zero, right? So the solution there is going to be, this is a harmonic oscillator, except it's got the sine, which is an exponential rather than an oscillating thing. So it'll be C e to the m squared, or m over the square root of C, t, C plus C minus e to the minus m t over the square root of C. Did I do that right? So dot dot will just pull down m squared over c squared, m squared over c, m squared over c, and then it cancels good. So then the full solution will be L of t will be L homogeneous, or the plus the particular integral. And the particular integral would be just integrate this twice. Actually, I don't really care what particular integral is. What's particular integral? The point I want to make is in the homogeneous solution. So in the argument that I made up here, you know, the point here is that there's four integration constants like we thought there should be. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. That's because we had more initial data we had to specify. And I wasn't particular about telling you which solutions we're talking about here. But in particular, the homogeneous solution here, anything involving C plus and C minus, they have the property. Remember, the small thing here is 1 over m. So recall that L. Wilson is only required to reproduce the full theory order by order in 1 over m. Because that was how that was why it was local in the first place, for example. When I wrote down something like this with just things evaluated at the same time, part of what was behind the blackboard there was that I was doing this expansion of 1 over m squared. And what you're supposed to notice here is that m is appearing in the numerator. You know, if 1 over m is small, so if you know, if we want a series in G, which is proportional to 1 over m, then something like e to the plus or minus some number times m, that's like e to the plus or minus some number over g. So this is the kind of thing that is smaller than any order. If you ask what's the Taylor series expansion of this in powers of g, you wouldn't get a good answer, right? This is the kind of thing that is smaller than any order of any power of g. So this is exactly the kind of thing that is not capturable by a series in g. And so these solutions are solutions that are explicitly not series in 1 over m. And so you should not believe them in the theory that was only defined, expected to agree with the full theory, order by order in 1 over m. So implicit in this statement here, what was wrong with the statement wasn't that it was just blanket wrong. It was that it's true for the solutions that make sense, order by order in 1 over m. And so in particular, you're supposed to be taking C plus and C minus to be 0. Because that's a piece of the solution that's varying way too fast to be an adiabatic solution. So the proper statement here would have been that the effective theory will capture any solution to DS to the full theory if you exclude these ones that are not within the domain of validity of things that are a series in 1 over m. Must set C plus equals C minus equals 0 to be within the domain of a 1 over m expansion. So with that proviso, it will be true that these solutions will be capturing the solutions of the full theory. In this case, I haven't written down the full theory for this guy. And then there's, in this case, only the two integration constants, which is what you would have expected if you have only one degree of freedom. So the bottom line is that it is true that if you get a solution for the effective theory with the proviso that you've got rid of these things that are oscillating way too fast, that are varying way too fast to be described as a power of 1 over m, when you throw those ones away, the remaining solutions, the ones that are slow, do capture the time dependence of the full theory because of this general argument up here. But it was important for that argument that you get rid of these very quickly oscillating solutions, or not oscillating, but varying solutions. And so in particular, the argument I alluded to before was that if someone said that this is an effective theory of the world that you should be thinking about for cosmology, there's a school of thought in the literature that says, well, I should actually exclude these theories because these theories have these runaway solutions, and so they're sick theories, and so I should only restrict myself to the kinds of physics that don't give this Lagrangian at low energies, with the belief being that if I did get this as a part of my theory at low energies, I would have to have these solutions as well. I would have to believe I had runaway modes, and then those runaway modes would have been after being capturing what's going on in the full theory, and I knew that I was starting with a full theory that wasn't sick and didn't have runaway modes, and so the logic would have that the logic that you'd like to dress this conclusion that you should exclude theories like that on is based on a false premise, and that is that all the solutions to this theory are equally good. You're supposed to be thinking of this as the unperturbed part and this as a perturbation, and these solutions here are not perturbative in the thing that is small. So the bottom line is, when someone hands you effective Lagrangian and they give you all kinds of higher derivatives in time, just shut up and work with it. Because all the alarms that would normally have gone off about higher time derivatives normally don't apply, because the solutions that are the sick things of the higher time derivatives, those exponential solutions, are not really there. Because you don't believe this theory is giving you anything that's more accurate than powers of 1 over m as approximations of the full theory. I'm probably flogging that to death, but anyway, those are the main messages for time-dependent things. Any questions? Alex, so that's the end of the time dependence. Any questions over there?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay, good. All right.
So anytime you have higher time derivatives, you could say that it's valid up to whatever that scale of that m is in front of
it. That would be the way you have to interpret it, yeah. Unless you have a system that has an instability. Right? I think that there's a class of theories which are not very well understood right now, and it actually comes up in cosmology, because a class of theories, a theory in this class would have been the Lagrangian where you take m Planck squared r plus something times r squared. That's the r squared. This has inflationary solutions where basically if you balance r against if you vary r, you'll get a solution where r is of the order of m Planck squared, c over m Planck squared, right? M Planck squared over c. So there's an equation, if the field equations for this have solutions which are behave like that, where that's, so it's a constant. Which you can kind of, if r had been the variable rather than the metric, then it would be kind of clear that if you vary it with respect to r, there's a stationary point here. The signs are probably not right, but and it's true if you do the full field equation that this is a solution. And this is nice because it's a constant r, so the Sitter space, and it's positive, so that's an inflationary solution. And you'd like this to be small, curvature small compared to the Planck mass, because you know that all your background curvatures are among the low energy parts of your problem, and so you'd like them to be small compared to the Planck scale. So you want c in this case to be huge. So so the people who apply this to inflation would like c to be something like 10 to the 8th. Because if you choose it to be that particular huge, that gives when you calculate the quantum fluctuations that generate the primordial fluctuations in the micro background, this gives you the right amplitude, essentially. And it's doing it because it's giving you a small Hubble scale compared to the Planck scale, and that had to be, and you needed this to be small compared to the Planck scale in order to have quantum corrections that were not large, because we were expanding in powers of small of the curvatures divided by the Planck scale. So C had to be large in order to have that whole picture work. And but this, if I write the metric out for this thing, the scale factor is basically e to the ht, where this is h squared. And so this is something which is going like e to the m Planck t over the square root of C. So that looks very much like this, right? And so all the alarm bells go off. And I think it's fair to say that it hasn't been resolved exactly what the right take is to take on this. Because I think there's two statements everybody agrees on. One is that as soon as you have something like this, you worry about, if I have C2R cubed and so on, it has to be true. If I'm believing this solution and not worrying about these other things, it had to be true that the curvature was small compared to the scale that sets the relative size of this term, of the terms in this expansion. And there's nothing that says that has to be, I'm saying this in a way that sounds complicated, whereas I'm not saying a complicated thing. So supposing that we got this Lagrangian by integrating out a particle of mass m, what would we have expected? We would have expected to get L to be minus m squared r plus some number order one-ish times r squared. is r cubed divided by m squared, and so on. And it would have been the same scale everywhere. And that's true. If there's only one scale in the problem, that scale would be this. So if m were m Planck squared over c, m squared, then I could imagine getting something like this. But then I would have the problem, I think everyone would agree, that I can't really trust this solution because this term is not negligible. This compared to this is the same size as this compared to this, and all the higher terms are the same size because there's only one scale in the problem that R is being compared to, and it's not m-Planck, it's m-Planck squared over, m-Planck over the square root of c. So, I think everyone agrees that that's not the way to think about this theory, but the people who push this theory would say that, well, supposing it were true that some physics gave you, for some reason, all these guys suppressed by M. Planck, and so on. And the only thing that does not have an M. Planck in it is this thing, because C is just a large dimensionless number. So for some reason, this one term is big, but the rest of the series is small. And then the question is does that make sense? And I think that's fair to say that I've looked very hard anyway myself at a way in which you could find that to be not self-consistent and failed. I think it's true that if you could find ultraviolet completion that when you integrate it out could give you something like this with a very large coefficient and give everybody else not coming in with a generic scale in the problem, or if the generic scale is the Planck scale for some reason, but this is for some reason big, then I don't see any reason why. Then it changes the argument here, right? Because then the series you're doing is really not in C over M Planck, and so the thing that's appearing in this exponential is now no longer the scale that you were having. It's really this scale M Planck over square root of C is much smaller than M Planck, and so this is much smaller than the things that you would have said are order 1 over e to the 1 over the small thing. And so it seems like it's a self-consistent framework to keep those kind of solutions in this picture if you assume that everybody is small compared to this one. Now what you can do is you can ask, well, quantum effects are going to actually start, you know, if I start drawing graphs with these guys inside other graphs, I should be able to start drawing C's in other pieces of the Lagrangian. And I've kind of tracked that through a certain distance, and it seems to be that you do get terms that are proportional to C, but you get them, the things you get are not powers of R. You get things like C, R, C, you know, grad R, some things like that. Things that vanish if R is a constant. So even though they get polluted by the largeness of C, they don't ruin the existence of a solution where R is a constant. So there's something going, so that I think it's fair to say that in effect, that it's not clear exactly what the domain of validity is for effective field theories where you just take one of the terms and you dial up a parameter by hand. The two things that are not known are, does there exist any ultraviolet physics that gives you that? I don't know of any examples that do that. And there's also just if you have that theory, is there a domain of validity of the calculations where it's self-consistent and doesn't give you any crazy answers and includes interesting solutions like that? And it's open whether that's true, I think.
Just real quick, why do you think the T of E, I mean, that's not the killing time, right?
Yeah, this is the flat slices, yeah. In inflationary applications, that's what you're normally doing, is you're looking at that, because you're thinking that something took you to inflation in the late times, you're just living in that part of the space. So it's kind of a practical question that comes up. And the things that everyone agrees on are that it can't be true that all these things are suppressed by the same scale. And it's a question of can you get away with it if you have hierarchies of scale like that? And if you can, what are the rules? Are you allowed to have this one big? And what are the things you're allowed to keep small given that this one is big? So a precise statement of what the rules are is not yet made, I don't think. Okay, so then there were a bunch of examples I was going to look at, starting with the simplest ones. And so which you think is the simplest depends a little bit on the traditional thing to do at this point is to talk about, you know, the W bosons and the Fermi theory of the weak interactions. But I think actually that's, and I could do that if you people want to see that. But if not, then that's the case where, you know, in cartoon form, the standard model has a coupling of a W boson to fermions with some matrix here, say gamma. And so, at low energies, those fermions can, in particular, they can decay because of the exchange of W bosons. But this mass, the mass of the W boson, is about 80 GeV. And until the early 80s, we didn't have enough energy to produce those particles. And so you're always working in the limit until the 80s, where this was a very, very short distance process because the energies involved were always small compared to MW. So Q was much less than MW. And so in that approximation, in that limit, in the same way that we've been describing things, that propagator, which was 1 over P squared plus MW squared, with eta mu nu in some gauge, that's becoming approximately eta mu nu, and I guess there's a factor of g at each vertex, so you have a g squared. That's becoming approximately eta mu nu g squared over mw squared. And so that says that at low energies, the effects of W exchange are going to be always appearing in the combination of the coupling squared divided by the mass squared. And so, and that combination was what you called the Fermi constant. That was g squared over mw squared, and there's a factor of 2 root 2 or something running around. So it's not right as equal, but... And so, of course, historically what happened first was Fermi came up with a theory of these decays where he had some sort of a contact interaction. So his effective interaction was G Fermi, fermion bar, gamma mu, matrix, Fermi, fermion bar, gamma mu, matrix, fermion. And he designed this to capture the phenomenology of, there's several levels of history, but Fermi proposed something which was not this sophisticated, but he basically had something involving 4 fields and this constant. And then in the 50s, this became souped up in a relativistic thing that took care of parity violation and everything else. But the upshot was always something like this, where you had a coefficient which was just taken from experiment as far as they were concerned. And so you'd measure the lifetime of a particle to decay. I guess you'd imagine that some particle comes in and decays into 3 particles. Like you could have a muon decaying to an electron, and a neutrino and an antineutrino. And then from the lifetime of the muon, you could figure out the value of G, which is where that's measured. So now what people can do is they can measure G, little g, in experiments where you actually were producing W's and Z bosons, and you can measure the mass of the W boson, and you can show that the values you're getting are consistent with the value you're getting there when you calculate that when it decays. So we're now in a situation historically that we have the full theory, we have the effective theory, and we can figure out what the effective coupling constant is in terms of the parameters of the underlying theory. And that's kind of the poster child of a low energy limit. It looks like it's not renormalizable, and back in those days they worried about it because it wasn't renormalizable, and in those days they didn't know how to deal with that or to deal with gravity. But now this is part of the story that tells us how to think about gravity, because this shows us in the full theory we can derive this as a low energy limit by integrating out the W particle, but we know that we're getting other things that are suppressed by more powers of the W mass, and this is just an approximation. And so that whole theoretical overlay that I was selling earlier on is coming from this very concrete example for which there's lots of experimental evidence. And so I could have done that in more detail, but it's probably, I think, the message is already there. So let's do something which is kind of more instructive. So the examples I was going to do now are from quantum electrodynamics. That's the next one, because what I wanted to use this is use this as a way to start talking about the renormalization group as part of it, and I also want to start talking about this matching story we have with the dimensional regularization. I'd like to make it more concrete, and I want to take the example of quantum electrodynamics with electrons and muons, and talk about what the effective theory is. You know, above the muon mass, below the muon mass, but above the electron mass, and below the electron mass. And along the way, that'll force us to think about different ways of renormalizing the running of the electromagnetic coupling. And it'll show you that dimensional regularization at face value is not such a useful one, but there's a kind of a hybrid way of thinking about renormalization, which is has the virtues of dimensional regularization, but also the virtues of a physical mass-dependent scheme in a way that will become clear when we look at the example. If you're happy. So let's do that. So in this case, the full theory will be just quantum electrodynamics, minus 1/4 f mu nu, minus psi bar d slash plus m electron, say, psi. And then sometimes we'll just stop with that, but sometimes we'll be interested also so sometimes we'll also think about having a muon here. So I have minus chi bar d slash plus mu chi, where d mu of psi is partial mu of psi plus I e a mu of psi. It normally would be minus I times the charge, but I'm using that the electron has charge minus e, and same thing for the muon. And this has a symmetry where a mu varies into the derivative of something, and psi is minus I e omega psi. Yep. And chi is minus I e omega. So the claim is that if I plug this and this into this, what happens is that when the derivative on psi hits the derivative of omega, that will cancel the variation of a here. So the derivative of omega coming from that. And we'll just be left with the thing involving omega undifferentiated. So the variation of d mu psi will be just be minus I e omega d mu psi. And similarly for d mu chi. So because of that, this is invariant, this is invariant, and this is invariant because f mu nu is partial mu a mu, and so in this difference, this drops out because we'll have two derivatives which are symmetric. So this is the gauge invariance that I'm sure you've seen. And what I'd also like to do is imagine that we have, in addition to electrons and muons, let's imagine that we also have big macroscopic charge sources, because that's actually what you really do in electromagnetism. They really are a whole bunch of electrons and protons, but let's imagine that we'll just think of them as being macroscopic sources. So we'll have something like plus J mu A mu, or say J upper mu A mu. And we're often interested in the classical response of electromagnetic field to some what we do with these currents. So we might imagine we set up a distribution of charges, and we ask what the forces are amongst those charges. Or we have a whole bunch of wires which have currents in them, and we ask for the magnetic fields coming from those wires. And then what I'd like to do is ask that question before and after I integrate out the electron and the muon. And yeah. Not directly, actually. That's actually a good question. So if you think of what could we have written down, like if you're thinking like psi bar psi chi bar chi or something like that.
Well, then maybe non-realizable.
Yeah, and that's the point. If I told you that I have the field a mu psi and chi, and the rules are you have to make a Lagrangian that's invariant under these transformation rules, then this is the most general renormalizable thing you can write down. They couple through A, yeah, because there's an A hidden in here. Yeah. But that's important because that says that that's the only way they couple is through A. And renormalizability is what made that so powerful. And so it is really true that in principle, integrating out heavier things in the standard model mean there are things like chi bar chi, psi bar psi, suppressed by something. But those are so small compared to this stuff that, that we never see them for the most part. No, think of J as being some classically specified current or something, so or some charge distribution.
It's just like psi, psi beta, P, and psi.
In principle, if we really were doing this honestly, it would be built out of psi because it's built out of electrons and protons too. So there'd be things that were not psi. But what I'd like to do is so that what that means that really I should be thinking of this theory not in the vacuum state. I should be thinking of it in some complex state describing the makeup of that current. But what I'd like to do is you could do that more carefully, and you could drive this as the effective theory for that, where the details of the structure of the current are not really so important, and all that really counts is that you've got an average current. So what I'd like to do instead is just think of this as being a classical function that I specify once and for all. So this might be something which is, you know, J mu might be delta mu zero, and some explicit charge distribution that I'll write down. And maybe it's a sum over positions of Q times delta of R minus the position of some charge, something like that. So just think of it as being a given function. And I'll be interested in how the electromagnetic field responds quantum mechanically, but it's going to mostly be classically, to that charge distribution. And I'm not going to really think of this as being microscopically coming from more electrons. And I'm just doing that because when I integrate out all these guys, we would have otherwise had a free theory. And so I want to have something, some knobs I can dial with so I can ask you what's the theory doing. And so I want to know how the electromagnetic field is responding to things, and I want to have probes I can probe it with. And so I'm going to use these for that, essentially. Okay. But that renormalizability point is important. You know, if it shows you that supposing that we had a particle like the neutrino whose electric charge was zero, then there's no interaction you can write down between it and the other ones that's renormalizable. And so that would explain why neutrinos interact so weakly, because they can't have a renormalizable interaction given the symmetries and the field content. So then their only interactions are suppressed by some scale. Turns out to be something like MW. And so that's that low energy is the explanation of why the neutrinos interact so weakly.
What in here is suppressing the mass of the neutrinos?
No, so if I wrote down, I'm not going to do this, but if I had, we could do it. If we added minus nu bar d slash plus m neutrino nu, then I would give you a number here which would be small. And there'd be a separate question as to whether or not, why was it small? So if I integrated out physics at high scales, would it have given me a big mass? For fermions, it turns out that's less of a problem than it was for scalars. And that's because there is a symmetry. The thing you're looking for is a situation where if I make this thing zero, is there more symmetry than there was before? Because if that's the situation, then what'll happen is that the corrections to this will have to be proportional to itself, because that's the thing that's breaking the symmetry. And so, and for fermions, that there is a symmetry like that. If I have a zero mass, then this has an invariance where I rotate the fermions not just by a phase, but by a phase with a gamma 5 in it. So if I take psi nu goes to e to the I omega gamma 5 nu, that's a symmetry without the mass, but it's not a symmetry with the mass. Because the psi bar here has a gamma 0 in it. And so so this symmetry protects the smallness of nu m. So if it happened that you made it small in the full theory, there's no reason why the successive integrating out of other particles will make it large. You'll find the corrections are proportional to itself, and we'll see that in here when I integrate out the muon. You could ask the same thing about the electron. Does the electron mass get a correction which is proportional to the muon mass? And you'll see that it doesn't. And the reason it doesn't is that there's a symmetry going on that's forbidding it. So these things are called chiral symmetries because they treat left-handed and right-handed particles differently. The gamma 5 is making them rotate oppositely. Okay. So let's first do, let's suppose we integrate out the everybody. So, and let's first put aside the muon. Let's just focus on electrons and photons. So we'll start with electrons and photons only. And we'll integrate out the electron. So we're going to be interested in processes where the energies are Q, the low energy, the energies of interest in whatever our process is, so the time variation of our charges, or if we're scattering photons, their energies, it's much less than the electron mass. And we're interested in effective theory below that scale. So the first thing, one thing to do is we just explicitly do the integral over psi. We get some log determinant of d slash plus m, and you could try and calculate that, and that's something, and you could do it order by order in E. But let's first write down kind of what's the most general thing we could expect to get. So L, the Wilson action, we're supposed to build it out of, it's some function of a mu. It's invariant under delta a mu, shifts by a gradient of some function, and it's local. Right, and we're organized as a derivative expansion. And here, there's only one scale in the problem, which is the electron mass. So what we'll do is we'll just use the electron mass, powers the electron mass to make the dimensions work, and then we'll have some coefficient that's dimensionless. So this will be the thing that's involved to be invariant under this. This is that says that we're going to always want to take A in the combination F mu nu. And the first thing we can write down is something like what we started off with, F mu nu, F mu nu. But there's nothing that says that we're going to get a coefficient of 1/4 here, because we started off with a coefficient of 1/4, but now we've done we've integrated out the electron, and so there might be some graphs that contribute the electron, make them correct, correct this coefficient of F mu nu, F mu nu. So let's call this Z. And so what I'm imagining there is that, there's a graph where you have a photon, an electron line, and a photon. And if I look at this, this is something which has two derivatives in it. So if I pick out the piece which has two derivatives in it, then the power counting that we had, this is going to be proportional to E squared, because there's an E at each vertex, because that's coming from the A mu, A psi, A mu psi is the basic interaction in the problem, and it's got a coefficient E. And so that's what we're looking at here. And then we would have had an integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth. And then we would have had 1 over p for each fermion. But we're looking for something which has two derivatives in the answer. So we're looking for something which has q over p squared in it. So this whole thing is going to look like, it's going to be logarithmically divergent, right? It's going to be, and I guess this is not p squared, this is p plus m, because the electron has a mass. So what we're expecting is that this thing is going to go like e squared over 16 pi squared. If we had a cutoff here, we'd have log of the cutoff. So we could do that if you like. We'd have log of lambda over me.
So can you explain why what you said when you were looking for some of the tutors in the answers, you included q over p plus m again?
I did it only once. What's really happening here, this is exactly what I did before when I was doing the general case. Mm-hmm. So what will really happen here, if we kind of had momentum q flowing in, is we'd have q flowing out. If we had p here, we'd have p minus 1/2 q, that's right, p plus minus 1/2 q. Say it again?
The first 1/p plus m squared, those are just the two propagators, right?
Well, they're really both coming from the propagator. So let me just do it a little bit more carefully. So So what I really would have is I'd have the integral d4p over 2 pi to the fourth times the trace in Dirac space, and I have a gamma matrix. Then I'd have a propagator, which is going to be something like p slash plus 1/2 q slash plus m over p plus 1/2 q squared plus m squared gamma matrix p minus 1/2 q slash plus m over p minus 1/2 q squared plus m squared, something like that, right?
Yeah.
So the thing is, what I'm doing is I know that the answer I'm looking for has two derivatives on the outside, so there's going to be the answer I'm looking for has two external momenta factors. It has the, in momentum space, that's going to look like q squared a to mu nu minus q mu q nu. That's the tensor structure that goes with that.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for something with that tensor structure. So that means that at least two of these momenta are going to be q's. Does that come out?
Okay.
And so I have to Taylor expand this thing to second order in q. And then once I've done that, I get two more p's in the denominator. That's what this was saying. So the upshot is that we should generically expect there to be corrections to this. We should generically expect them to diverge. And the efficient way to do this would be in dimensional regularization. So I might as well write it down here now. So if I actually calculate what z is, so since I've started this, let me finish this thought. So z is going to turn out to be, let me give you the answer that you would have gotten if you did that in dimensional regularization. I wasn't expecting to get to this as fast as this, so let me just. So this turns out to be 1 minus, so the 1 is the thing we start off with, and the next term is coming from this graph here. It's basically, it's alpha over 3 pi, 1 over epsilon, plus a number, which I'll tell you what it is in a second, plus log of m squared, m electron squared over mu squared. So what are these things? So epsilon is, I took the number of dimensions to be 4 minus 2 epsilon. That's what epsilon is. K is the, it's the Euler-Mascheroni constant minus the log of 4 pi. So gamma is just a pure number. It's a 0.577215, da 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 da. So it's the Euler Mascheroni. And mu is the next thing you're going to ask what it is. And so the important thing to know here is that if in dimensional regularization, there's a scale mu running around because, you know, what I should have done when I first started this, before I'm doing this in the order I didn't expect to do it. We went through and we found the dimension of all these fields, right? When we asked for the Lagrangian to be mass to the fourth, that told us that the field A had to have dimensions of mass, and that the derivative was dimensions of mass, so this whole thing was mass to the fourth, and so on. And once we knew the fields, then we knew that this had dimensions of mass, and this had dimensions of, E A mu had the dimensions of derivative. And so since A had dimensions of mass, that meant that E was dimensionless. But that whole argument was done in four dimensions. So if I'm going to be in dimensional regularization, we have to go back and think it through again. And in particular, E is not going to have dimensions. It's only dimensionless in four dimensions. So let's think that through first. So let's use this board here. So this is an aside on dimensional analysis. Analysis in dimensional regularization. So our Lagrangian, the business end of our Lagrangian was we had f mu nu. Then we had minus psi bar d slash plus IE A slash psi plus other things, right? And you're all happy with the slash notation, right? Like slash A slash means gamma mu A mu. If this is the, these are the Dirac matrices. And D slash is gamma mu partial mu. So these are the Dirac matrices. And psi bar is psi dagger I psi dagger gamma zero. All right, so let's count the dimensions, but now let's do it in n dimensions rather than in four dimensions. So in n dimensions, the action was the integral dnx of the Lagrangian. The action is always dimensionless because it has the dimensions of h bar, and h bar is 1. So that means that Lagrangian has dimensions of mass to the n. So now if we go through here, it's always true that derivatives, coordinates have dimensions of length, and so derivatives have dimensions of 1 over length, so they have mass dimensions derivative is the dimensions of mass to the linear power. So that means that this is a derivative times a field, a derivative times a field. So that means that the dimension of the field Amn has to be, it has to be n minus 2 divided by 2. Right, so if n were 4, this would be 4 minus 2 over 2 is 1, which is what we had before. But in general, in n dimensions, the gauge field or any bosonic field would have dimensions which is not mass. It'll be this power of mass. Similarly, the dimensions of the fermionic field, it used to be, it's going to be dimension n minus 1 divided by 2. So if n had been 4, this would have been 3 halves like it was before, but it's not that in general dimensions. And so now the dimensions of E will be, it'll be the Lagrangian, which is n, minus the dimensions of the gauge field, which is n minus 2 over 2. And then it'll be minus twice the dimension of the fermionic field. So that'll be minus n minus 1. So n minus n, we get a plus 1, we get a plus 1. So we've got, this is n minus 4 over 2. Did I get that right? No, minus that, sorry. 4 minus n over 2. So if n were 4, that would have been 0, but it's not 4. So it's not 0. So in particular, if n is equal to 4 minus 2 epsilon, then E is mass, has dimensions of mass to the, so 4 minus n will be 2 epsilon divided by 2, it'll be mass to the epsilon. So what you normally do when writing a formula like this is that we'd like to have E be dimensionless. So what we'll do is we'll write E as being, let's say E naught times some mass scale mu to the epsilon. And that's just some random fictitious mass scale, which isn't really there because we're not really in n dimensions. We're in four dimensions, and we'll just have to track what happens to mu. And nothing should depend on mu. Nothing physical should depend on mu. And that mu is this mu. And this E is really the, I should have said alpha here. Alpha is E squared over 4 pi. And this E is really the, what I'm calling E naught there, but I'm not going to call it E naught all the time. So this E is the dimensionless E. And the reason that you get logs of mu is that when we're, you know, when we're looking for the poles here, we have a function of dimension. If we evaluate these integrals in dimensional regularization, we get something which is n dependent. And what we're doing is we expand it around n equals 4. And there's a pole coming from one of the gamma functions, but there's other things multiplying it, which are also functions of n. And so what happens is that you have a function of, you know, of n times a pole, then that's going to be a function of 4 over epsilon plus the derivative evaluated for, you know, times something of order epsilon, where the epsilons cancel, plus order epsilon. And this derivative sees things like this. So if you know, mu to the epsilon, I can think of that as being e to the epsilon log mu. And so that's 1 plus epsilon log mu. So if I start differentiating with respect to the number of dimensions, then I start picking up logs of mu. And so that's where that log of mu came from. It happened because we had a pole, and we had to go out to order the epsilon dependent piece included the expansion of this thing in powers of epsilon, and that's kind of where what happened. Okay, so that was a bit of a long aside, where the bottom line is all you really need to know is that if you explicitly calculate this coefficient z by doing this, the integrating out the electron, that particular coefficient turns out to be this in dimensional regularization. So one of the conversations we'll have to have is, what do we do with this? This is our divergence. What do we do with the mu's? And the good news is that the mu's are going to always come with the poles, because the reason you have a mu is that you had a pole which then hit at an expansion like this of something of this thing in powers of epsilon. And so the thing that cancels the epsilon will be the thing that also allows you to see that the mu's are canceling. So, but we'll have to track that in detail. So that was just a long diatribe as to what z is. And now what we want to do is we want to work our way down a derivative expansion. So what's the next thing we write down? So,
excuse me, what is the alpha?
Alpha is e squared over 4 pi. Yeah, I didn't write that till the very end.
Okay.
And it's this dimensionless e here, that what I called e naught here, but I'll never call it e naught again. Whenever you see an e, it's always dimensionless, and I've always implicitly pulled out this factor of mu to the epsilon.
Okay.
Let me rewrite this in the next board, because it's kind of getting buried by other things. All right, so our Lagrangian is going to be minus 1/4 z f mu nu. So the lowest dimension thing I can write has dimension 4, so there's no masses in it. But we can also write things down with more powers of derivatives and fields. We have to have an even number of fields and derivatives, because to get an invariant, we have to contract it with an epsilon symbol or a metric. So the next thing is we could have had something like, let me use the same notation I'm using in my notes. The wild card will be that I've got more than one set of notes here, so my notation probably changed. There we go. So we could have had A over M electron squared F mu nu box F mu nu. We could have had A prime over M electron squared D mu F mu nu D lambda F lambda nu. We could have had B over M electron to the fourth F mu nu squared. We could have had C over M electron to the fourth epsilon mu nu lambda rho F mu nu F lambda rho. And actually, the way I'm doing this, 1/2. She calling back? See how that goes. Let me actually write it with the factors of 2 that I had before, because otherwise I'm going to lie to you here. F mu nu, F twiddle mu nu squared, where F twiddle mu nu is 1/2 epsilon mu nu lambda rho F lambda rho. And we have things with so this has a total of 4 f's and 4 derivatives, but we could have also had things like d to the 4th f squared terms and so on. And I guess I should have written, if I'm allowed to write f f dual, I could have also written up here, I could have written here, let's call it the letter we haven't used yet, h F mu nu, twiddle. Epsilon is this. I'm using the epsilon symbol to contract indices. And the reason I didn't write it the first time is that this is actually a total derivative. So the total derivative, which you can see because that's, if I write it as epsilon mu nu lambda rho partial mu a nu partial lambda a rho, and then the anti-symmetric things are all tied up in the anti-symmetry of this. I can always integrate by parts. I can write this as a total derivative by pulling the derivative out, and then I have to then differentiate what's left, but then I have two derivatives acting on A. That'll be symmetric contracted with something anti-symmetric, so that'll be zero. So this is d mu of epsilon mu nu lambda rho a nu partial lambda a rho. So because of that, you don't normally write it. It happens that if you have a non-abelian group that this can be important, but for the abelian groups it's not normally important. I've already, you know, this one, what I want to do now is I want to argue that so the claim is that H, A, and A prime are redundant. But in the following sense, that what you're supposed to notice about this one, I'd say, is that the, you know, the lowest order equation, the lowest order action was this. And the equations of motion from the lowest order action. So notice that, except I forgot to write, there's also the plus j mu a mu term, which is going to be important for what I'm about to say. That was there originally, remember, and I'm just carrying it along for the ride. That's just this term here I'm talking about. So if I think of this and this, H was just this coefficient here. I just wanted some. I'm going to throw it away right away. So I was thinking some letter I'm not going to ever use again. So those, the things that are all suppressed by m electron masses are this, 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 and this. So I'm going to think of this and this as being the zeroth order Lagrangian. So the zeroth order equation of motion is a very the gauge field. It's going to be minus z d mu f mu nu plus j nu is equal to zero. And so if I use the equation of motion, I can convert this into j nu kind of a term, right? So that means that this can be rewritten as a prime over z me squared j nu, which doesn't involve the electromagnetic field at all. It just involves the current. This one here? Not necessarily. So it depends on if I write down when I write down an explicit function like I said I was going to, the rule has to be that I write down something which is conserved. So it has to be true that J satisfies that div J is equal to zero identically. And so that would be true in this case if this did not depend on time, say. Or if I have a current, I have a current that is satisfies div J equals zero and doesn't depend on time, that would also satisfy conservation. And as long as that's true, then that'll be gauge invariant. Because if I replace this by the derivative of omega and integrate by parts, I'll get the derivative of j, which will be zero. So the bottom line is that suppose I'm interested in photon-photon scattering or something, then these two interactions are actually, I haven't dealt with yet, but this interaction will never actually be playing an important role for photon scattering because I can trade it for something which doesn't depend on the photon at all. I can trade it in terms of things involving J. If I'm asking how the system responds to changes in J, which I will be doing, I need to keep this because this is something which knows about the current. It's something which is not irrelevant for physics, but it's not, this expression and this expression are the same expression from the point of view of physics. And this is a more useful one because it's something which doesn't depend on the electromagnetic field. It depends on just the explicit currents that I wrote down. So what I'll do is I'll trade this thing for this thing because of this. The argument for doing so is that, remember, whenever I can always simplify an effective interaction using the lowest order equation of motion because I can accomplish that by doing a field redefinition. And previously when I did that, I was making it, if the current had been zero, this would have vanished, and then I would have just thrown this away because I could have made it shown that it's equivalent to zero using the equation of motion. But the difference between this and this is an equation of motion. It's proportional to this. And so I can always do a field redefinition of the gauge field, which will convert this into this. The same argument I gave before. And there's a similar argument here that if I write the equation of motion you know, it's d mu f mu nu is equal to j nu, let's say. In terms of the gauge field, that says that d mu a nu minus d nu a mu is equal to j mu. If I choose a gauge, if I use the freedom to redefine a by a gradient to ensure that the divergence of a is equal to zero, so this is Lorentz gauge, then with this gauge choice, this vanishes because this derivative hits a. And then I have that that box a is equal to j. So now if I take another derivative with respect to d nu and I take the antisymmetric combination, I'll learn that box of f mu nu will be d mu j nu minus d nu j mu. So if I use this in here, I can trade that for dj dj. D mu j nu minus d nu j mu. It's just they just give me a factor of two because that's antisymmetric already. And then if I integrate by parts, I'll have j, I'll integrate by parts, the derivative will hit f, and then I can use the equation of motion again, the div f is equal to j. So this is again a jj term. So the claim is that both this term and this term can be traded for a jj term. So an equivalent way of writing that Lagrangian, which is more useful from the point for what we're going to do later on, is L is minus 1/4 Z f mu nu plus j mu a mu. That's like the zeroth order L. And then we could also have a piece which is, let's call it A over M electron squared j mu j mu. That's what we got, right? And then we also have these other pieces here. So plus B over m electron to the fourth, f mu nu squared, plus c over m electron to the fourth, f dual mu nu squared. So I'll come back to this next time, because there's two pieces to get out of this. One of them is to the order. You know, almost all the classical applications of electromagnetism that you do are working to zeroth order in one over m electron, because you're thinking of you have classical electromagnetic fields and you have classical charge distribution, so that would be just this stuff. And so the only way electrons are appearing there are through Z. And so one of the punchlines will be, as long as you're, when you calculate things like if I have a charge distribution and I solve Jackson, you know, I go to Jackson and I solve for some field configuration that's coming from some classical charge distribution, you might have worried, you know, is it true that if I thought of that as being I have a current and I have electromagnetic field and another current interacting, am I really doing, is this part of a graphical expansion where I should be including all possible things like electron fluctuations and you know, photons going across like that? Do I have to worry about quantum corrections? Are the corrections to the classical expressions I normally write down governed by a series in the fine structure constant? And then this is showing you that actually no, that the all the corrections that you would get when you integrate out the electron, they're there, but at low energies, they're all suppressed by powers of 1 over me squared, up to this z. So the only thing we have to think about is what the z thing means. But apart from this z thing, all the stuff to do with quantum fluctuations in the electron are all suppressed by the electron mass squared. And so the corrections to all of the classical calculations you would have done when you did Jackson problems are actually not just some series in alpha. They're actually a series in 1 over me. And that's a much, much better series, because normally you're at energies that are enormously small compared to electron mass. And you might have thought the corrections to what you did in Jackson were only good to one part in 100, because alpha is 1 over 137. And it's actually much, much better than that because you're really doing a series which is more like controlled by energies in your currents divided by the electron mass squared. So that's a great thing to know. And then we have to come back to what Z means here. And so that Z mean, you'll see that the issue for Z is that I can remove Z by scaling it into A, but then it'll reappear here. So it'll be useful actually to keep an explicit factor of the electric charge in front of J. So I'll do that next class. And when I do, when I scale Z out of here, it's going to reappear in here. And so it'll look like just a change in the value of the electric charge. And then, so that's what's going on, is that this Z is telling us about the renormalization of the electric charge. And that's going to have an important role because if you measure the electric charge at different energies, it's going to be different at different energies. And that's going to be that difference in energy is going to be an important thing that's buried in Z. And that's the only place where these fluctuations are playing any role at all at low energies. And they're not. So Jackson is safe from quantum corrections apart from the value of the fine structure constant. You look like you got a question building.
Yeah, so are you just, is Z really just charge mineralization?
Essentially, yeah. It's going to. So that's going to lead to the there's several choices of a renormalization scheme we can use. One of them is we scale Z out of here, and that'll move it into the charge, and we'll call that the physical charge because that's the one where we're using the normal Maxwell equations. If we had a Coulomb field, that would be the one for which we'd have E squared over 4 pi r is the Coulomb field, and that's how we would have measured our E. We would have said it's the coefficient of 1 over 4 pi r. So once we scale Z out of here, that E will be the physical E. So that's a renormalization scheme. And you'll see that once we've done that, when we express things in terms of A physical and E physical, then all the stuff about the poles is gone. But more interestingly, what we'll do now is we'll go back and we'll another in dimensional regularization, another way in which you renormalize is minimal subtraction. And that's where you define your renormalized quantity to be, you just subtract the pole here. If you just subtract the pole, that's what you mean by minimal subtraction. If you subtract the K as well as the pole, that's modified minimal subtraction. And so what we'll do is we'll use modified minimal subtraction, and that'll subtract these guys. And you'll see that means that we can compare the electric charge defined in minimal subtraction to the physical electric charge defined over there, and they will differ in such a way that you'll see that the electric charge defined in minimal subtraction has to depend on mu in order for the physical charge not to depend on mu, because nothing physical can depend on mu. And so that'll tell us what the mu dependence of electric charge is, and then you'll see that that's actually a very useful way of seeing where logarithms of electron masses are appearing in answers when we ask questions about if we when we integrate out the muon, say, we want to know where is the muon mass and things, there'll be logarithms of m mu over m electron, which we can count very, very simply by knowing the mu dependence of the minimal subtraction coupling. So there's a whole story there that we'll go into in more detail.
The other thing I was wondering was when you were trying to explain why a neutrino mass would be really, really small because of the chiral symmetry. If the symmetry was spontaneous inversion, you expect a really small mass. Yeah. There's two things. One was you wrote a new Dirac equation, But don't neutrinos not couple the electromagnetic field?
They don't. Yeah. So they, that was a in the neutrino case, wherever it is. That's not a D. That's a partial.
Oh, okay. Okay. Got it.
Yeah. That's.
So the chiral symmetry only exists if it's just partial, not if it's.
No, it's also true for the electron mass. So it'll be true when we integrate out the muon. That you'll see, you don't get a correction to the electron mass, which is proportional to the muon mass. You'll get it, the correction to the electron mass will be the electron mass times the logarithm of the muon mass and electron mass. And for the same reason that if I set this to zero, I again have a symmetry where I can multiply this by gamma 5, because this is invariant even if there's an A there. For partial and D, it's the same.
So I guess what I was wondering is why, if that's the reason why the muon mass is so small, why isn't the electron mass also?
It's not the reason why it's small. It says that if someone hands you a theory where it's small, the process of integrating out particles what doesn't change that, so it'll stay small. So that means if you wanted to understand why, it doesn't explain why the electron mass is light compared to the muon mass, but it says that you may not know that until you know what the theory is at very much higher energies, because it could be solved there, And then the process of integrating out the physics from there to here wouldn't change it anymore. It wouldn't ruin the fact that it was small. So that means that that's the kind of that's called a technically natural hierarchy, that this is smaller than that. And what that tells you is that you may not know how to solve that until you actually get to those higher energies. Nothing forces you to have to solve that at low energies.
Whereas for the mass of the electron, or what?
Yeah, why this is smaller than that, or why the neutrino is smaller than this? It's something which whose solution may be at high energies, and the process of integrating out the high energies doesn't change the fact that there's once you started with a small, it stays small as you integrate out higher energy physics.
So sorry, what would happen if there wasn't that symmetry present?
Well, for a scalar, if you had a scalar, what would happen is that as soon as I integrate out something of mass m, I get a contribution to its scalar mass, which is of order m, and what that says is that generically, if I just take random stuff at high energies, I won't ever find scalars that are light because the corrections, their mass will typically want to be big.
Is that because this was the idea that even at low energies, the thing that you integrated if you integrated out something of mass m, now the lighter particle of mass little m would acquire a correction of order mass big m?
Yeah, what's happening is that if I took, let's say I was... say that there's some physics here that at some scale m, and I've got some scale a scalar phi, and in the effective theory here I've got a piece which is mu naught squared phi squared, so L is equal to this, and then and down here in the Wilson action for the here, and I also have things involving, say we've got a fermion psi bar of psi phi or something like that, so and then there's a psi bar d slash plus m psi or something like that. So here's a theory where I got a fermion, I got a scalar, and the scalar couples to the fermion with some coupling G. And if I look at the effective theory down at lower energies, it doesn't have the heavy fermion anymore because it gets heavier. So this will just be, it'll have something like minus 1/2 or minus mu 1 squared phi squared plus other stuff. And this value of mu 1 is going to be, if I calculate mu 1, I can calculate mu 1 from mu naught and m. So at the classical level, I'll get mu one squared is equal to mu naught squared, but then a loop of fermions will give me a contribution that also contributes, and it'll be of the order of g squared because there's two vertices, times m squared over 4 pi squared, or something like that, times some number, probably with a pole, one over epsilon.
Okay.
But the important thing is that once I renormalize things, the renormalized parameter mu one is given as the difference between, or the sum of mu naught squared plus this contribution. And so let's say that we know that this is small because we're assuming that phi is very light, or we measure that phi is very light. Then for this to be small, since this is huge, this has to also be huge in such a way that they just very precisely cancel to give me something small. Well, it's logically possible that it happens, but it's just, we know of many situations where we have heavy things and light things, and in any of the theories we actually understand, that never happens. But it's logically possible it could happen, but it just seems very bizarre, particularly if this cancellation is detailed. So in the if this had been the grand unified scale and this had been the Higgs mass, then this cancellation has to happen to like 30 decimal places or something like that. That just seems pretty weird that you'd have this very, very precise cancellation going on. Normally what happens is that if you have a small number in your effective Lagrangian, then everywhere, in any place you choose to write the effective Lagrangian, you always understand why it's small. It's small here, it's small here, it's small here. And whenever, and that's what's true, for instance, for the electron, for the electron mass. If we had a m electron psi bar psi or chi bar chi, if it's small in this theory, when I integrate out this other fermion, it's still small here. I'll have m electron 2 chi bar chi, and this one is this one times some logarithm of m. So if this is small, this is also small. And there's no special cancellation that has to happen between this and some other loop thing to make this small. And so in that case, no matter where you ask the question, in any effective theory, it's always small. And that's the way things normally work, is that you understand why things are small at every scale. And this kind of cancellation between the bare value and the quantum corrections is very unusual. That never happens. So what people do is they say, well, that's probably telling you that the physics at scale m, there will be choices for the physics at scale m where it's not like this. For instance, supersymmetry is a famous example. If I have psi and I also have some other new boson, I need another variable, zeta, you know, d zeta, d zeta, so some scalar, then what normally happens is that the scalar contribution is the opposite sign for the boson. So we'll get G squared. If it couples, if there's a G zeta phi zeta or something like that term in the potential somewhere, then we'll get a G squared M zeta squared over 4 pi squared. So if the couplings were exactly the same, as this is G zeta, say, if these couplings are the same and if these masses are the same, then this would actually cancel. And then it would be true that as I integrate through here, if I eliminate both these particles together, then they don't get a big correction. And so that's the supersymmetry idea, is that they had to cancel. If they're not exactly the same mass, then we want the difference in their mass to be kind of the size of the failure to cancel. But that tells you that whatever, if that's happening, this difference can't be too large. It can't be much bigger than the mass of the Higgs. And so that's why it's useful, because it says that we're talking about physics we haven't discovered yet, but it can't be at arbitrarily high energies. It has to be happening at an energy which is tied to a scale we already know about, the Higgs mass. Whereas the electron mass, it might be it's at the Planck scale. We learn maybe we don't know why the electron mass is small until someone tells you with the string vacuum we're living in. And that's a logically consistent point of view, because then once it's small here, as you integrate out things, it stays small. And there's nothing that forces you to understand it here rather than up here. But for scalars, you're being forced to understand it as soon as you hit some place which was not canceling in this nice way.
Since your original theory respects parity, does that mean you don't write down one of those parity violating?
Yeah, things? Right. If you, all the symmetries, if you have symmetry of the full theory, you'd want this to satisfy the same symmetries, right?
Oh, yeah,
but that this respects parity, right? Because there's two of them. So if I just said FF dual, that would not respect parity, although it happens to be total derivative.
Oh,
but as soon as I square it, it's okay.
Yeah. Is that one also zero?
No.
Square.
Yeah, but square of a total derivative is not the kinetic term is a square of a total derivative, right?
That's, oh yeah. Okay.
That's not a total derivative.